Hey, it's the end of the year. This is Mugtoe Radio. I've just got some stuff out of the can. Some stories. Same old stories. Some poems, however. A little verse. Some love sonnets. Some rants. Some vignettes. I've been dragging this out so long. I'm supposed to be doing this every week. I'm lucky if I'm doing it once a month. So, I'm still going to leave it listed as weekly. Screw it. But this was going to be the Christmas show. Anyway, or the Christmas installment. It's the end of year installment for Ranch Radio. Mugtoe Radio. Radio Mugtoe. Free Kevin. All right. Anyway, so that's the story. And I got all kinds of little shit in my keyboard. I'm going to get this booger on the road. Get this show on the road. All right. As my grandfather used to say, I wouldn't have that in my ass if I had room for a sawmill. I don't know what that's supposed to even mean. Sadie Morrow didn't give a shit that I was queer. She wouldn't have given a shit if I'd have had a third eye in the middle of my forehead as long as I'd make her feel desirable from time to time by fucking her and letting her buy the beer. She'd bring me offerings of broken men in the same way that my cat would bring me a half-eaten horny toad if only I would pull her up against my naked, sweaty body and give her my finest sloppy sugar and then cover her face with the glaze that left her looking like a day-old southern-made donut. Sadie bestowed the best upon me that her feminine charms could offer. I was happy that she was so solicitous of my physical comfort, but I honestly felt rather put upon and objectified from time to time by that slut-in-the-headlights look she gave up at me from below my belt. Striving after the pleasures of the flesh was a way of life for me then, however, so I sucked it up and made the best of a dubious blessing. I've always been adaptable that way, I suppose. And she gave the most hateful hot bubbling skull I ever got from a woman. That counts for a lot in my book. I met Sadie in an AA meeting. I was killing time in the back row of one of those midnight candlelight gatherings where the unemployed and the unemployable sit about and try to outdo one another by speaking in hushed tones and secreting spiritual goo all over the room. I always felt as if self-support and right living were about the most spiritual things a man can do towards his fellows, no matter that I often fell a tad short of that mark, and I usually attended these funereal powwows to simply lord it over those who were somehow less aware of truths I considered to be axiomatic. Besides, once I'd been wired up past about day 3, I tired of staying around the house once the sun had gone down. I knew that such a group of misfits and heathens weren't going to be too terribly discriminating about the company they kept. I saw her sitting with her back to me, recognized her as a familiar face to whom I had never been introduced. As the group formed up at the close and was about the task of joining hands to ask for their pat on the head, I slipped up behind her and whispered, "I can lick my eyebrows and breathe through my ears, Princess. Can I taste what you had for lunch?" She was trembling all through the Lord's Prayer, trying to contain herself. I never considered that line terribly, witty. But I suppose that it did come as a surprise under the circumstances. She turned and fell into my arms as the lights came up and we had a little moment. She looked up at me, biting her lower lip, and pressed her tits hard against my chest. I determined right then that conforming her to my will was a biological imperative in my life. I wanted to drag her outside and fuck her in the parking lot, and I found the awareness of that rather disconcerting to me. I am, after all, queer. There have been a few women in my life who have had that effect upon me, but they are so few and far between that I don't take them into account when it comes to assessing my orientation. Sadie was not a fat girl by any stretch, but she had a comfortable fleshiness about her that I found very attractive. She was not any taller than I was. She also had that innocent look of a girl who blew her brother on his wedding day, but only because he guilted her into it. She had platinum blonde hair, sky blue eyes, fair-sized perky tits, and that look on her face that said lights were on and anybody was home who happened to be passing through. She trembled a lot, it seemed, and I felt sometimes as if I were in the company of one of those little dogs who roll over and piss themselves when approached too quickly. She also had a jiggly whimper that said she'd just been caught being naughty and she knew what she had to do now to get a pat on the noggin. I was well known among the creatures who took up residence in those smoke-filled rooms with the bad coffee and worse furniture. There had been times when I had honestly wanted to make the attempt and offer my base metal into that alchemical chamber to see what sort of gold issued forth at the other end. I had more often witnessed the effects in my life and the lives of others who tiptoed around the periphery of that process without ever giving themselves completely into it. For us, it was a spiritual sausage grinder, combining all the more unpalatable elements into an inert puree that, while safe to eat, had none of that spice that makes life worth living. I'd just go to get the heat off periodically and spend my time auditing the course and hanging with the other like-minded folk who were in and out of the doors and occasionally drunk in meetings, pitching pennies at the speakers from the front rows and being escorted out when we were too disruptive. Sadie wanted something better, but anything was better than the cold plate of circumstance she brought to the table when she arrived. She went through all the requisite motions in her own way. While I sat in the living room of my grandmother's house smoking speed off a piece of foil, she would scribble nervously at the kitchen table in a stenographer's pad working on another of her moral inventories. She carried that process with her as she sought relief in the immediacy of one more anonymous coupling on my shag carpet. I had somewhat of a crush on Brian, a guy who rented a room in the back of my house and sold coke on the strip in Dallas where he tended bar. Okay, so it wasn't exactly a crush. I just wanted to suck his dick and do his dope. His dope was pretty painful stuff. He was selling coke for Claudio, who owned a restaurant and bar over on Fitzhugh. That bar was called La Mariposa and was located next door to where the old Eighth Day had been just a few years previous. Brian and I would spend afternoons there doing shots of Grand Marnier and snorting 80-cent lines off the bar. There was something not quite right about the coke. It felt like ground glass in my nose, though it was powerful enough. We had to continually use various nose sprays and other medicaments to alleviate our suffering. Brian would send me across the street to get hot dogs with mayonnaise, a taste I acquired at the time, but to which I never fully adjusted. Then he would we'd chase them with shots of Grandma and a thick line of coke that almost brought the entire mix right back up. Then we would stand around for a few minutes holding our noses and wincing and trying to swallow. Brian held forth in such a way that he wasn't really queer. I mean, he was queer, but the boys he was attracted to were either illegally young or so effeminate that he might as well have been straight. And I knew he was good to go if I had a girl that was worth fucking. I was a bit of a chicken hawk and always have been, but I wasn't in the same category as he was, and I wasn't willing to venture down that road for any reason, no matter how skewed my perceptions became. Sadie provided an easy avenue of compromise for my taste, since I was willing to fuck her in any case if nothing else was available. It was a hot time and memorable, and it only happened once. I reckon it's appropriately unfortunate that my principal visual memory of Sadie is the three of us scooting along my living room floor, Brian's pelvic thrusts, the engine of our progress, and Sadie's blissful grin upon my cock affixed, until her head was bent near double against that old console television that used to blare out Soul Train on Saturday afternoons while my grandfather sat a few feet away rolling cigarettes and running the electric shaver over his face and laughing as the sun streamed in through the big picture window.
Glazed eyes follow whole paragraphs without comprehension. I somnambulate, carefully. Shh. Crawl into bed. It works. Until body sunk heavy in the sheets, a vex neglected stirs, gathers bits unto itself, agitates further, brain roils, gut joins brain, eyelids draw up, with grinding gears cut off all dream traffic, open now to steaming rage, heels strike floor, though shoulders ache still for the sweet soft peace of the pillow. What enrages me in the night? Helplessness the base, a weak hand in overwhelming circumstance, bad faith in those with control over our lives, officials unwilling to move, users are rage teasers, money changers in the temple. Is that why God never sleeps?
Gavin's got ass that won't quit. I can't believe that shit comes out of something so fine that ain't mine all the time, but his talk was so whack, I'd rather jack it off to his mom, or Tom, or any other mother I can drop the mugnut bomb on, who won't so prize that he's uncircumcised or think he's wise, telling lies to the little people in his head. Yeah, he's been in my bed, but he ain't the only one I'm gunning for in this romper room of crusty boys. My joy is breaking them down where they shits, like Ron Ritzer, only I don't drop the bits in convo, so don't sweat it, you'll get it, and then it's like you'll forget it. Till the next time the fat boy rhymes his cock in your face with the only bass, the slap of my nuts on your chin, with your shit-eating grin, because what's worse is I was in your ass first, and what you thirst for is more what's dripping out of both ends now, filled up to overflowing, knowing that you really like it while you back it through town like Fry, and oh my, I ain't going there, and don't you dare either, because he's a teether, and I'm still raw from putting my cock in that maw. Kevin DeBrew will be through with the rhyming once he's chiming in with the rest from the worst of the best who passed their asses and grasses through my nest and ended up with my goo in his chest and in his hair and everywhere till he's looking like I cooked him up like a Krispy Kreme glazed and raised his ass in the air and filled him, eclair fashion, with a ration of leftover cream from the last seam I split. My cock is covered in your shit, son. Don't run away yet back to Green Bay, okay? Something else Mom did called Green Spot. I remember Green Spot. It confused me at first because in the cold, clear, squat bottle with a lime-colored disc on one side waited a drink as orange as any. What is so orange as an orange itself? My mother, the poet, explained that a green spot is an oasis, a cool drink in the desert. That made sense, because the dust was everywhere. We'd stand in the shade of the two-pump gas station at some crossroads on the two-lane highway, use the privy out back, and cool our throats with icy drinks from the box in the office. Back in the 30s, I could understand desert. No rain, no water. We hadn't heard of La Nina. All we knew was drought. Strangers passing through Ma Thorne's place would turn off the road at the mailbox and drive down the dusty lane, open the big gate, drive through, and carefully close it, lifting and carrying it back to its proper place, to keep the cattle in or out, then fix the chain. I guess a chain, can't really remember that, except for the sound of those loose metal pieces ringing and rasping. That was the gate to heaven for me. The stranger drives from the gate and stops at the windmill close to the big house for a cool drink in the desert. The tin cup is used by everyone passing through and by us. I guess there was a pump handle in case the wind wasn't blowing. I can't remember. How many chaws were shifted from mouth to cheek before the cool water passed brown lips? That didn't matter. It didn't occur to anyone. At least they didn't remark on it in my hearing. Everyone used the tin cup. It was the one I put in my mother's gentleman friend's Model A, as mechanics later during the war would put their gum on the planes taking off on bombing runs, a way to go along in spirit. I went in spirit with them, or with her. I didn't know him so well yet. My mother and my adopted father-to-be said they were mighty glad to have that old rusty tin cup when they stopped at Dexter on the way back to Sherman for her and Austin for him, because they were thirsty, and the well at Dexter wouldn't have been an oasis without the cup. Not everyone was as hospitable as Ma Thorne or as accommodating. I remember how she took me at the age of 2+ by the hand and showed me my limits, all around the yard, the fence. Wonder how big that yard would look now. By the orchard in the south, the field, gate, tenant house on the east, the barn lot, and storage sheds on the north. A big no-no. The west field, whose lane led to Uncle Joe's and Aunt Maud's house by the spring branch. Tom and Patsy and their older brothers, Joe, Billy, and Albert, they all lived there. I couldn't just take out and go there without a grown-up. Those were my horizontal limits, and I tested them only once that I recall. I followed Tom, age 5, through that west gate into the field. Uncle Joe and some other men were piling something on great heaps around the west field and burning whatever it was. I remember the eerie light made by the afternoon sun filtered through the smoke. Much later, I was told what they were really doing, and I was delighted to learn it, but can't remember now what I was told. Unless it was Patsy who said it, everyone who would have is gone now. I could see the men silhouetted against the late afternoon sky with a smoky haze, giving the scene a rosy, orangey, strange feeling. Monet's haystacks put me in mind of that day. I could feel the fine silt of the lane under my bare feet and between my toes as I followed Tom. And then I saw Ma Thorne back in the distance, coming through the gate and bending to one side to pick a switch. I was terrified and comforted by the consistency of the rules laid down. I was in for it. Make the best of a bad situation, I had learned from my mother. Pick flowers, miraculously growing behind the nearest upturned stack. Run to meet her. Don't spank me on my leg up here, Ma Thorne. It's sore. Spank me down here below my knee. I don't remember what happened next, but my mother received a report. I told her, and she repeated it many times. No, she didn't spank me, but I deserved it. This was evidence to her of my moral growth and cute personality at the time, she thought, and told that story almost till the day she died here in my house with my daughter and me holding her hands. Well, those were my horizontal limits. The vertical one, to my memory, I never broke. Patsy says I did. I think it must have been she or Sue who climbed up past the second crossbars in the windmill. She was the daredevil. Someone had to be rescued from the very top amongst the blades. I know I would have been too frightened of the height, though I did climb to the top of the cellar roof one day. Those old gray shingles were easy to climb up on. So there I sat on the ridge of that low roof where eaves nearly touched the ground like the shanty in old shantytown. Every little movement of air threatened to topple me to my death. Was it Cousin Alden who offered to hold my hand as we both slid down? I was suddenly aware of how dry and splintery those shingles were. Could feel them in my bare bottom, could feel the splinters threatening my thin cotton panties. I was a terrified queen for that day, sitting on top of a rickety world with everyone below looking up at me and trying to coax me down. I wouldn't budge till Imogene Dick came up and took me in her lap, folded her protective arms around me, and slid down on her own skirt. Perhaps that was the beginning of my agoraphobia. But I love mountains and I enjoy airplane flights. The cellar stood beyond the water tank, I think, just east of the chicken yard and before the garage, where there was a gas pump, just like at the filling stations, for farm machinery, I guess. But it was a long way to town, and cars needed it too. Out in front of the garage is where I remember Ma Thorne in her blue-checked apron and sun cap stirring a cauldron of lard on a fall day after the hog killing. She showed me one day the little face soaps she had made with pink food coloring and cologne. I guess she went easy on the lye for those. They lay in a pan or cookie sheet, all pink and sweet-smelling, on a shelf in the little screen porch between the kitchen and the windmill, the kitchen and the bath laundry next to it. Had cold running water pumped in from the windmill and running hot water. We ran it from the stove tank to the bathtub or laundry tub or kitchen sink. In the heat of summer, a cousin and I were cooling off in the barrel of water by the windmill when we saw the cow coming for a drink there. I think that was the time I broke a record reaching the upper vertical limit of my kingdom. Then there was the cold day when the big icicles formed in the crossbars that held the huge water tank aloft. That was when Ma Thorne made ice cream. Hank Coldwire says he had ice cream once in the summertime when the hail came down so thick his daddy called for the freezer and they gathered enough to fill it. Barney Blankenship described an epiphany he had when he realized that ice cream spooned up from a bowl as the adults ate theirs far surpassed the drabbles the kids got to tongue from the dasher as a reward for cranking the freezer. I guess some stout older cousin cranked the freezer at Ma Thorne's. I can't remember. Maybe even Uncle Joe. He was always there. Of course, we were already cold, so we sat around the wood stove in the dining sitting room next to the kitchen and toasted our toes while we spooned the cold stuff. A treat in the desert. Green Spot came in squat, squarish glass bottles with a bright green circle painted or stamped on it, contrasting with the orange drink inside, and it was refreshing. My favorite at filling stations on those hot, dry drives back to the farm from Austin till I drank five of them one hot day and threw up. Then Delaware Punch became my favorite for a while. I go into your room every evening after work. Sometimes I take time out during the day. I've been meaning to tell you there's a wasp nest covering one entire wall by the door. Today I went in while you were staring out the window. I said hello and waited for you to respond. The wasp began an angry buzzing. I suddenly realized I'd worn no clothing. It was so impolite of you not to respond while your yellow jacket stung my naked flesh. I bit into the head of one caught in my teeth. It curled its stinger into my lower lip. I did my very best not to shout or carry on. After all, you didn't ask me to disturb your wasp nest. It's not like I didn't know it was there. So I can't say I blame you for being annoyed with me. I tried not to look too terribly awkward. The swelling should go down in a bit, and perhaps nobody will notice that I set the wall to buzzing with my clumsiness and best efforts. I was relieved that the swarm finally abated some, and I was allowed to put on some pants. You finally turned to me and said, "I think we need to talk." That, my sweet companion, is such a comfort. I can see how hard it is for you to find my swollen, scarred flesh attractive, the smell of venom weeping from my pores. It hurts you. Our feelings aren't always mutual. Sometimes I think you deserve a fucking medal.
Catfish is best when you get really drunk on Kentucky Deluxe and grub for it naked in a polluted stream within sight of the skyline of Dallas with a whore you picked up at the Debonair Danceland going through the glove box of your truck while you pontificate from the shallows up to your eyebrows in sewer runoff and your hands around a cottonmouth or a carcass of some sort. Then you pass out on the shore, wake up with your truck gone, wander back into town and get religion, go to rehab and end up sleeping on the floor of one of your dad's rent houses. That's what I like about Catfish. Snow crunches underneath my feet in styrofoam snickers, scarce comfort against the face-splitting cold that blasts the years away this instant, filling me with tremble and squint at the cloak of icy needles pressing down and into me with a wicked whisper, I am. I am standing in the heat that wraps around and fills my lungs with dusty syrup, thickened in the holes I dig for trees that rarely live or matter much, except in planting. There's the fun, the joy of gambling with life on the edge of a shovel, or bitch about the bugs, and still I'm here. It's cold, so goddamn cold I'll never sweat again. And nights spent tossing, wishing air would move and grant me rest in cool, dry sheets upstairs with the windows open in the trees.
I've been to a fair number of rehabs in my life, usually at the suggestion of an attorney or to get the heat off for some way. And then back in August of 96, I got my third DUI. I mean, there wasn't any open container law in Texas when I got my driver's license. I was used to just making a drink and going down the road. And I was rarely too drunk to drive, but I was frequently too drunk to get pulled over. So anyway, one of the upshots of that happening was around December of that year, I went to this rehab out in Abilene, Texas. And I had a great time out there, as a matter of fact. I was over there over the holidays, Christmas and New Year's, and into, I guess I finished up towards the end of January. I stuck around in Abilene. Initially went to this halfway house that was owned by Billy Saul Estes, where we had family meetings every weekend, every Sunday. And my dad would send me postcards every day, every goddamn day. And he'd ended each one with, in big capital letters, "Don't drink the Kool-Aid," because he knew who Billy Saul was. And then I got me an apartment over on North Judge Ely Boulevard for a few months and ended up smoking crack in Abilene, Texas. Buying crack over on North 13th. And so I went on back to Irving. What the hell? Not doing me any good to stay here in the middle of nowhere, East Bobitch, India. And I had quickly made friends in Abilene, and I was not shed of them completely when I returned to the Dallas area, nor did I wish or seek to avoid them. I had not left near as much wreckage in that West Texas town as I had in the other places I had lived up to that point. I'd only been back in the Dallas area about a week when I received a call from a girl in Abilene. She was coming to the Metroplex to get an abortion and wanted me to keep her company for a couple of days. This was a Friday. She was going to have it done on Monday. She told me that she had ample funds and party favors for me. I'm never one to ignore a cry for help, so I felt it my Christian duty to play host to such a delightful host organism. She was one of the few women towards whom I ever felt a romantic attachment, and I thought I might make some headway in that regard by being so attentive in her hour of distress. I don't think I ever considered such a mindset mercenary, but upon reflection, I might rethink that view. Abby followed me to my new home and told me she had a present for me. She'd met me at work and followed me back to the apartment. This was when I was at Plantation View Apartments, not far from Texas Stadium, right on the edge of the Trinity River bottoms. She came into my apartment and produced a syringe full of Dilaudid, which she graciously administered herself. I hate playing nurse to my own arm, though I am more than competent where others are involved. And this was the last weekend I ever shot dope. 1997. I'd never done Dilaudid, but I'm always open to new experiences. Besides, it was a gift. I didn't want to appear rude. The needle was not even out of my arm before I felt a pleasant warmth pervade my whole body. This was quickly followed by a truckload of euphoria running over my body and leaving me smiling and wanting to puke. The next 3 days are somewhat of a blur. We did copious amounts of heroin and cocaine and drank round the clock. We really smoked crack more than anything else. I vaguely remember being in a one-room apartment in Dallas where we stayed for the better part of a day doing heroin and smoking crack. I ended up living in that same building over on Knight Street a few months later. It was over in Oak Lawn, the neighborhood, the bubble, God's little half acre. It seemed to be in much better shape by the time I moved into that place. I rode with Abby to Fort Worth to have her abortion, and she returned to Abilene shortly thereafter. I betrayed her confidence to someone in the Abilene social circle, and she's since not spoken to me. I don't blame her. I don't have any feeling about it whatsoever, really. One of my old girlfriends from high school came to visit me about this time. She's a story in herself, but I'll tell that another time. She stood in my doorway looking out at the parking lot. A look came over her face, and she turned to me and said, "Frank, somebody's cooking speed around here." "Nonsense," I said. "Ain't nobody in this complex but a bunch of drunks. They just keep weird hours. You're imagining things because you're such a fiend yourself." She persisted in her assertions, and I allowed as how it was possible that there might be the odd speed freak in my complex. It was certainly out of the way and quiet enough, but it was impossible that any large quantities were being moved in my vicinity, because my razor-sharp sense of the criminal would have picked up on it. I was so blind. I've always prided myself on being a quick study and very perceptive. The truth is, I don't recognize the underlying patterns of things until they're presented to me in widescreen technicolor with a bouncing ball spelling out the lyrics. I don't recall how I got acquainted with my next-door neighbor, R.W., but it turned out that I was living a few feet from the largest meth dealer in the area, with a constant traffic of illicit product issuing from his door right under my nose. I should be a cop. I'm so stupid. Perhaps I just don't have a suspicious nature. Consequently, a career in law enforcement is out of the question. For the same reason I've never been preyed to bouts of paranoia so prevalent among friends I've known, I think I offered my good neighbor a beer at some point and invited him into my hovel to enjoy my company over a Red Dog. That's what I was drinking at the time. I'm an easy person to know, and I don't shy away from introductions. I wasn't particularly interested in joining the hosts of speed demons who, as it turns out, were crawling all over the complex, so much as I was simply interested in knowing what was going on and thought that it couldn't hurt to be on the man's good side should I ever want just the merest sampling as a medicinal comfort for the stresses of my workaday life. I think I smoked a joint with R.W. as a way of showing common cause and giving myself an air of harmlessness and face validity in his eyes, I don't remember exactly, but it seems like the kind of thing I would do even today under the circumstances. Like most people in his shoes, he had an all-pervading paranoia coupled with a sense of his own invulnerability. I never brought up Crystal. I figured it was more important to establish a rapport with him as a neighbor. I'm patient in such instances. What really broke the ice for us was the arrival some days later of an old acquaintance of mine who happened to be coming to RW's to make a purchase. I greeted him at my door, which essentially joined my neighbor's own. I invited him to come visit once he was finished with his business. He returned a few minutes later with RW in tow, and we all sat down to break real bread. All pretense was dropped at this point, and my character was vouched for by one of the most heinous gangster types I've ever known. He's also one of the sweetest psychopaths it's ever been my pleasure to talk to. This same man who introduced me to RW's inner circle has held me in his arms while I cried like a baby in broad daylight in a crowded parking lot. His name was Jim Butcher, and I believe at the time I broke this down, I believed he was serving a mandatory 25-year sentence as a habitual offender there in Texas. We used to call it catching the bitch. Turns out he wasn't. My doorway opened obliquely to a view of the Dallas skyline. There were trees to the right, which shaded the parking lot where it ended just short of my apartment. And two more units stretched past mine towards the levee of the Trinity River just a few hundred yards away. The ground sloped off after the last unit and disappeared in a tangle of trees and undergrowth that was impenetrable to most normal folks, but habituated by speed freaks who'd gone native and lived in a semi-feral state. They appeared every so often to re-up and then dissolve once more into that scorched green soup behind my home. On the other side was a thickly wooded area which was just as uncongenial for afternoon walks. The floor of that urban forest was littered with broken glass pipes thrown from apartments in fits of sudden paranoia or in favor of newer instruments when the soot and accumulated dregs in the bowls made them unpalatable, no longer capable of cleaning them. There was no lack of true fauna in that neighborhood. Once, while I was tripping alone in my apartment, one of my favorite ways to pass the time, I became aware of a scuttling noise in the ceiling over my kitchen. I assumed that there was a pretty healthy rat going about its rounds up there somewhere. Next to the center of the fluorescent fixture in my kitchen, there was a small hole about 2 or 3 inches in diameter where once there'd been an incandescent light with a globe. I was peeking on acid, and my vision was becoming at best fluid, having a little difficulty keeping objects fixed in my focus, but I placed a chair directly under the hole and climbed up to investigate. I thought perhaps I could catch a glimpse of the vermin, for what purpose I cannot fathom. I had no means of dispatching it, even if it had remained still and allowed me to do so. I had managed to get my face within about a foot of the ceiling by standing on tiptoe on this chair when a furry little hand shot out towards me. I screamed like a little girl and fell flat on my ass on the floor. There was a raccoon in my ceiling. I learned from the neighbor at the furthermost end of the building later that it was a large female with distended nipples and an evil disposition. I count myself fortunate to have survived the encounter intact. I immediately gathered up as many cans of household chemicals as I could muster and sprayed them at the opening in an effort to make it unpleasant portal of ingress. I eventually settled down a bit and was able to view my guest with uneasy ambivalence. The landlord finally ran her off by tossing cotton balls soaked with fox urine into the ceiling space. I hope she didn't kill any binkers in the river bottoms after her departure. I became somewhat better acquainted with RW as time went on and found myself once again experimenting with sleep deprivation as a means to heightened awareness. After 3 days, the growth of trees and grass becomes discernible to the naked eye. Conversation becomes difficult, at least in the customary sense. A new language develops through an economy of words and poor enunciation. I began to have visitors at odd hours. I guess it became known that I was one of the tribe, and my apartment became a safe place to escape from the kitchen light for all those cockroaches. One of the feral bankers came to my back door one night late. I let him in and continued to smoke as he watched porno and mumbled to me in an effort to become better acquainted. Porn is like the background noise to my experiences with the Evil E. I've never taken much of an active interest in it otherwise, but there's a certain level of masturbatory insanity that goes hand in hand with doing crystal. I shared with him some of my own experiences and allowed as how the distinction between the two sides of the coin of sexual orientation was a blurry line for me. I forget the guy's name, but he had a girlfriend who would follow him from place to place and increase his torment. He was always running from her at night and pursuing her in the daylight. Neither of them were much to look at, yet I will assert that everybody has some aesthetic value, which is increased exponentially after several days and nights of smoking meth. He surprised me a little by making advances of his own. I was not in need of company, but I found it an interesting diversion. Speed does strange things to people who otherwise would fall within the parameters of normal sexual behavior. I've seen this event countless times with guys who I thought I knew well after many years' acquaintance. This guy was no different. He excused himself from my presence and returned a few minutes later with a little overnight bag from which he produced a few articles of women's clothing. He insisted on doing a little dance for me in a lacy little teddy and then got on his knees and begged me to take him like a teenage whore. I told him I wasn't up to the job, but I was sure he was a good little girl. He then produced an instrument from the bag, which I think was a dowel rod of about 1.5 or 2 inches in diameter, wrapped in duct tape. He asked if I could perform the act with this as my proxy. I declined once more, but told him he was welcome to do whatever he liked in my presence as long as I was not a part of the process. I find this kind of thing fascinating, and while I don't encourage people to push the envelope, I've never discouraged it either. Cannot describe the scene with any justice, but it was 2 hours at least before I finally made him stop and take leave of me, as it was getting close to time for me to go to work. I found out a couple of days later that my late night visitor was on the FBI's 10 most wanted list, or one of those lists. He continued to come around from time to time and then eventually wandered off when things got too hot for him in Irving. His picture was down at the post office, I know that. There's a density to time in these matters which is difficult to explain to the uninitiated. I was a resident in this community for no more than 2 months, yet there was a compactness to my experience there that expands that period a great deal. Normal chronology does not apply in recounting these episodes. They are filed away in zip files in my mind. When I try to access them, they continue to expand and I discover bits of data which were otherwise obscured before retrieval. The situation with my neighbor began to deteriorate within a short time. Someone borrowed his car for about 2 weeks. Upon his return, a horrid stench arose at our end of the parking lot. Rumor had it that someone had been killed and left in the trunk for an extended period in the early summer heat. The car had to finally be removed. No more was known of it, at least by me. A few days later, I was puttering around the kitchen after work when a crowd hustled past my front window and stopped in front of RW's door. We had a wall that we shared. They were all men and dressed in black with helmets and stern faces. I wasn't completely aware of what was going on, and the entire episode occurred within a few seconds. I heard a loud noise and saw a bright flash outside my window, accompanied by a great deal of shouting and scuffling noises. I thought it impolitic to close my blinds or evince any other signs of undue distress which might call attention to myself, though I was only a few feet from the scene and in full view. I did my best to behave as if nothing out of the ordinary were happening. After a few moments, I went upstairs to my bedroom. My desk was at the window, which overlooked the scene below. I sat down to call my father and tried to close the blinds in front of me. They were jammed. My heart was racing a bit. Below me was the entire tactical squad of my town with the occupants of RW's home spread upon the grass. I felt as though I were the new fall line in a department store display window. I was clean and without a pang of conscience, of course, but the last thing I wanted to be lying in that lawn attracting chiggers and being threatened by the local Hitler youth. I stayed in view as long as I thought proper, and then nonchalantly got up and laid on my bed to await the departure of the boys in black and a return to normalcy. It turned out that the bus was a dry run. As far as I could discern, they came at a time when RW was out of stock and awaiting the delivery of the next batch. He didn't actually cook anything at that location. I'm glad of that in light of the volatility of the process and the negligence common among cooks. RW continued to deal a bit longer, though in a much diminished fashion. I never crossed his threshold again. I skipped out of that complex a week or so later amid much remonstration from my landlord. I pointed out to her the wildlife in my apartment and the next door and told her to send any bills on absorbent paper in order that I might make better use of them. RW moved out about the same time as I did. I arranged his move for him. I was working at a moving company and realized a handsome commission on the job. I've never been back to that neighborhood and doubt that I will. I don't know what happened to my nocturnal visitor, but I trust that he's leading a normal, productive life somewhere and is a boon to his community. I learned on 13th of August 2001 that Jim Butcher passed away from cancer the previous May. He'd been released from prison. He was the kindest, most sensitive, and perhaps the most murderous man I ever called my friend. He was one of those guys that stood while the real man, would eat over at Campese's. He was just kind of muscle, I guess. But I loved him very much.
Encased in amber, lying in plain sight, the memory of life with you remains, but inaccessible. It only stains my hours. Loving you was never quite as satisfying as it now would seem in retrospect, though I would otherwise have argued in the past. But wounded eyes govern these perceptions, beautiful dream of mine, and I am left tracing the lines of a fading image behind a shell, impenetrable, receding. My hell is my creation. Heaven intertwines. Forgive me if I linger over long. The power of this image is too strong. How irrevocable the sudden shifts of feeling, loosing the bonds of two lives so long held together. One holds, one strives to break free, and with us, one falls, one lifts himself with new supports. All those new friends who swarmed in, dazzling, new interests found, apart from what was shared before, unwound the cord becomes, and finally it ends. A counterfeit memory all I hold of what was once authentic to us each. I trace the outlines, vainly try to reach the substance that is quickly growing cold. And with your newfound happiness, I see the biggest part of us, it seems, was me. Two combatants, they contend, and striving against each other, tearing tender flesh, they rend themselves where once they sought to mesh. The hearts that would otherwise be driving in unison towards a common end, and then their struggles abate and both rest from fighting. The wounded lovers, lest they finish the test, they have to mend, or this contest would finally end, ease into their corners, treat their stripes, and face that they do not know how they reach this place of battle. How can they, this conflict, cease when the alternative to bloody war is indifference, to touch no more? I hope that I'll not die without the chance to grip those pallid orbs with my embrace, or with my kisses its contours I'll trace and further the experience enhance. The gravity that pulls me down to die has not yet loosened those two hemispheres. Your birth, my death, distant by equal years, compels the urgency with which I vie. So at the end of life, my heart's desire is nestled in that cleft I might expire.
There's something Dad wrote. Wait upon me, courage, for I come from far away, from a land of night and shadows, peopled by demons, ghosts, and fears, and worst of all, by bad decisions, by things left undone when I knew I should have done them. It is not the things achieved that fall short to haunt and flay me. It is those many things not started, not attempted, those tongues unlearned, those songs not sung, those oceans going to sky, with no bark of mine afloat to see the great green hills beyond. Wait upon me, courage. I would yet see those hills. Though they be not green, but sere and brown, I would speak that lilting tongue they speak, though haltingly, and hear the laughter of their young. Who would not know the miracle that I spoke at all? Wait, I need thee, courage. Tomorrow and tomorrow and tomorrow creeps in this petty pace from day to day to the last syllable of recorded time, and all our yesterdays have lighted fools the way to dusty death. Out, out, brief candle. Life's but a walking shadow, a poor player that struts and frets his hour upon the stage, and then is heard no more. It is a tale told by an idiot, full of sound and fury, signifying nothing. We'll be right back.